The Takeaway is supported by Netflix original documentary series Hot Girls Wanted, Turned On, from Rashida Jones, Jill Bauer, and Ronna Gratis. The series explores sex and technology in a digital age. Hot Girls Wanted, Turned On is now streaming only on Netflix.
It's The Takeaway for Friday, April 21st, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. We thank you so much for listening on this Friday. And another major march appears headed for Washington, D.C. Hundreds of thousands of people are expected in the Capitol this weekend in the first ever March for Science. The march is set for Saturday. That's also Earth Day. And it's linked to scheduled marches in other cities across the country and around the world.
Hi, my name is Liz Bradley.
This is Annika Danes.
I'm Lana.
I will be attending the March for Science.
My daughter Teresa and I will be marching while I am visiting her in St. Louis, Missouri.
I will be marching in Eugene, Oregon, rain or shine.
I'm going to be marching for science in Jacksonville, Florida, because the great thing about science is that it's true and very real, whether or not you believe in it.
Organizers and the marchers that you hear there on our takeaway line say their goal is to present a united front in support of scientific research and evidence-based policymaking. It's a fact-based worldview many people feel is under attack in the current political climate and under the new administration of President Donald Trump. Science celebrities will be on hand to increase the media attention, of course. People like Bill Nye and Christiana Figueres. She's one of the architects of the Paris Climate Accord. But the event has also drawn some criticism from within the scientific community itself. Some scientists feel that the march only further politicizes a field that shouldn't be political at all. Ira Flatow is host of Public Radio International Science Friday. He's the legendary host of that show. He's in D.C. for the march, and he joins me now. Welcome back, Ira.
Thank you very much.
Ira, this March for Science really started with grassroots activism online. There were rumblings of this as much as 2 or 3 months ago, right after the success of the Women's March after the inauguration.
Yeah, I remember when we did a show on Science Friday months ago, and we had one of the organizers on, and she was as surprised, I think, as anyone else about the tremendous interest shown by the public. You know, people, as your little Vox Pop showed there, that there are average people who are coming to this march. They're not just scientists who are coming here. And even though it may have started out looking like it was just organized by scientists, there are going to be thousands and thousands of, quote, average people coming to the march.
So this is kind of perfect for us, Ira. I mean, you're the radio science talk show host. I'm the political reporter. I used to be a science reporter myself. and this is great because this is the clash between politics and science in so many ways. They've always been in tension. Politicians exploit and distort science all the time to meet their needs. So what's different now that people are pouring into the streets?
Well, I think, you know, to quote an old movie, I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore. I think is the attitude of scientists and people. They've watched science come under attack. I mean, most recently, we talk about the Trump administration and things about cutting money for the EPA and the NIH. But, I mean, in one jaw-dropping statement in Congress a couple of weeks ago when the head of the committee, the committee that funds science, says he doesn't believe in the research that comes out of Science Magazine, which is the most trusted American magazine for science credibility. He doesn't believe the credibility of that research. That brings science to a whole new level. The debate is not just with the White House now. The debate is about funding and funding priorities for science in Congress, which gives the government most of its money to do the science. So it's much broader than that now.
So a couple of different levels then. Certainly there's the politics of NIH funding, CDC, you name it. There are agencies across the government that are popular that fund research. There's also, it seems to me, the generalized questioning of a fact-based worldview. We mentioned it in the intro. You mentioned some of the politicians that say Science Magazine is fake news. I guess I'm paraphrasing. It seems like this clash is happening on more levels than it used to.
It is, but, you know, it used to clash. I mean, you can go back to science and politics, back to Galileo and the church. you can move it up to closer to Einstein warning President Roosevelt about the Nazis and the bomb. You can move it to Rachel Carson, a biologist doing Silent Spring. You can move it to Barry Commoner and Paul Ehrlich and Carl Sagan warning about the environment in the late 60s, the threat of a nuclear winter in the 70s. So there has always been a tension between science and politics. But what is different now is that, like Social Security, the funding of science has always historically been taken for granted. That's, you know, we need to fund research. That's where jobs are created, by the science that we create. We create technology. Technology leads to jobs. That was usually a given. You didn't have to go and argue for the funding of science. Now, within the political atmosphere we have in Congress and in the White House and budget cutting, people have to say, are you kidding? You have to be convinced why we need science. And it also may lead to the disconnect that led to Donald Trump's victories, that scientists themselves and may need to connect more with the public and get out and show them on a local level why science is important.
And many of them, Ira, as you know, don't like getting up off the bench to address the public, but a lot of them don't like being involved in politics at all. There is some criticism, as you know, from within the community saying this isn't our place. We're totally data driven. No politics. Is that an option these days?
Well, that's always been the criticism coming from other scientists. But I think now scientists have realized this. And on the local level, they are now getting more out into the communities and reacting. I think in Michigan, other states, creating more town meetings, going into schools, showing up and showing that scientists are real people. They're just like you. I used to make a mistake of separating scientists and people, but they are people. And I think this march shows people who are going to see it on television or anywhere else that these are real people out there on the streets just like they are.
Ira Flatow and his staff from Science Friday will be out in the streets in Washington, D.C. with their microphones on Saturday for the first ever March for Science, one of a long string of protests that have hit Washington, D.C. this winter and spring. I can tell you that. Ira Flatow, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Well, the data and the facts of climate change are likely to be a big part of the backdrop of Saturday's planned March for Science. The issue isn't as divisive, though, as our politicians like to pretend it is. Large majorities of Americans believe climate change is real and should be addressed. And one recent Gallup poll found that more than 7 in 10 Americans favored protecting the environment over increased fossil fuel production. Now, those facts certainly are at odds with our current politics. President Trump was elected as a Republican, saying climate change is a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese. He's promised to pull out of the Paris Climate Accords, and his EPA chief, Scott Pruitt, is a leading global warming skeptic, an ally of fossil fuel companies. But there is a glimmer of organized environmental resistance from within the ranks of conservatives. Debbie Dooley is trying to win Republicans over on the issue of clean energy. She's president of Conservatives for Energy Freedom and the Green Tea Coalition. Debbie, welcome.
How are you doing today, Todd? It's very nice to be with you guys.
Well, thank you. It's good to have you. Debbie, Green Tea Coalition is catchy. I get it. It's a little bit environmental. It's a little bit Tea Party. What does it mean to you?
It means that a group of people, activists from both sides of the political spectrum, coming together to work on conservation issues and work on providing true energy choice and energy freedom.
Now, you're a conservative and a Republican, is that right?
That is absolutely correct. I've been a Republican activist for like 40 years.
Well, what I just said a few minutes ago, 70% of the public believes in climate change and believes it's crucial. The story really hasn't been the public's opinion on climate change. It's really been the alignment of Republican politics with the idea that climate change basically isn't worth addressing with national policy. It seems to me that that's really where your fight is.
Well, I agree. I totally agree. But you have to understand, conservatives have been conditioned for years by groups like Heartland Institute that man is not damaging the environment, that, you know, renewables are bad. So I'm working to fight that. And what's really interesting, Todd, is that Heartland Institute in the 1990s took money from big tobacco to convince Americans that secondhand smoke posed no health risk. The very same, many of the very same groups are doing the same thing with renewables and stating man's not damaging our environment.
Now, if you're going up against the Heartland Institute, you're going up against the Koch brothers because they back the Heartland Institute with a lot of money. So what's the Green Tea vision for addressing carbon emissions and fossil fuels in a real policy way? I mean, your Republican sister and brethren don't want the government involved in regulation or taxation. They just want to be able to do business, and sometimes doing business means polluting.
Well, I'll tell you, I support, and many, many people support, a free market solution. You know, one of the things, if you think about, let's remove the regulatory barriers that exist that prohibit renewables from competing on a level playing field in the free market. And my thing is, with Republicans, I don't care whether or not they agree with climate change, that they think man's damaging the environment, as long as they're advancing renewables. Rick Perry, when he was governor of Texas, he did not believe in climate change, but he advanced renewables in Texas. And in Texas, the renewable industry field employs over 100,000 people. He did that by basis of it's good for the environment, it's a responsible thing to do, and it's a free market solution and choice.
Well, that's the business case, and maybe the head of your party might respond one day to the business case. Debbie, you're in a party where the head Republican, President Trump, has called climate change a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese. He's not going to wake up one day in the next year or two and tackle climate change in the way that you want. Neither is Scott Pruitt over at the EPA, for that matter. So what are you hoping for realistically? What's a win for you between now and 2018, say, in the real world?
Well, I think a win for me would be for them to give a lot of research and development money for renewables, to actually fund a lot of the renewable projects, which is actually in President Trump's infrastructure spending plan. I don't agree with what he said about climate change, but I will point to the fact that there was a poll released in the end of November 2016 that found that 75% of Trump supporters actually like renewables, and they think that we should do more to advance renewables. 75%. And that's what I'm stressing. The left and right needs to put 85% of the issues we disagree on and work together to protect our environment, to protect the earth God created, and be good stewards for future generations of America. America needs to lead on renewables and not let countries like Germany lead on renewables.
It's the Green Tea Coalition. Debbie Dooley is the head of it. Debbie Dooley, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Supporters of Marine Le Pen sing the Marseillaise there, the French national anthem, at her rally in Marseille on Wednesday. It was her final rally before the first round of voting in France's presidential elections, which come up on Sunday. Le Pen heads the right-wing Front National, and she's one of five candidates in serious contention on Sunday. Analysts don't expect an outright 50% winner, which means the elections would continue for another few weeks. The election is a test of the nationalist populist phenomenon in the United States and Europe. On top of that, candidates are reacting to a terrorist shooting last night on the Champs-Élysées in Paris. It left one police officer dead and two people injured, and ISIS claimed responsibility. James McCauley is Paris correspondent for The Washington Post, and he joins me now. James, how does this latest terror attack impact the approaching elections?
That is indeed the question on everybody's mind. This is a highly contentious presidential election that has been brewing for months now. And the thing, though, is that really up until now, there hasn't been a sort of defining issue that the election is, in a sense, about. You could have said that it was about globalization, that it was about fighting unemployment, that it was about any number of different themes. But now, in the truly kind of the final hours of the election campaign, it's about terrorism, and it will remain that way on voters' minds. We have every reason to believe.
Well, if in the final hours before the first round of voting, this is now about terrorism, can you give us a sense of whether that shifting election dynamic plays to the advantage of any of these candidates? I mean, Marine Le Pen from the Front National has certainly been the most famous candidate to Americans, especially during the white nationalist phenomenon globally and in the United States here. But let's go down some of the other candidates and just see maybe who gains an advantage here.
You know, I don't think we know for certain how exactly this will play out in the end. I mean, as you rightly say, on some level, the ideal scenario for a Le Pen victory would be an attack like this or bigger right before the election, because it revives the kind of recent anxieties over terrorism, and then would conceivably drive voters closer to this very hardline candidate who has, you know, just this morning she called on the government to reimpose border checks, you know, to expel foreigners in France who are on this thing called the S dossier, which is sort of if you've been suspected of some kind of crime like this. But, you know, we don't know for sure if in fact it will sway that way, because, you know, in the past, there has been precedent where it hasn't. In 2012, for instance, there was the I don't know if you remember, there was the shooting a few weeks before the vote in Toulouse at the Jewish school. And Nicolas Sarkozy, then France's conservative president, with a reputation of being very tough on crime, he didn't end up winning the 2012 election as a result of that attack, which analysts at the time said could have played into his hands. And of course, Le Pen is not the only candidate who has a sort of hard line on terrorism by any means. You have François Fillon, the centrist conservative, who just this morning delivered very, very strong remarks, kind of almost in the same vein as Le Pen herself. It really remains to be seen. We really don't know. And the truly unprecedented thing about this election is that any scenario is possible in the next 2 weeks. You know, of course, on Sunday is the first round where the current number of candidates will be whittled down to two. And then 2 weeks later is the final round where we'll know the winner.
And as you mentioned, we have a wide spectrum of candidates at this stage. There's also Emmanuel Macron, who's sort of the establishment pro-EU candidate. Of course, it's France. You have to have a socialist. That's Benoît Hamon, correct?
Right. But in fact, you know, Benoît Hamon, despite being the standard bearer of, you know, the party that has really dominated French politics and European politics, for that matter, for decades, is trailing in the polls. And so he's not actually one of the leading contenders numerically at the moment. What we have is really a contest between political outsiders in the sense of party affiliation. So France has really never been run by somebody who wasn't a part of the center right or the center left, so to speak, since 1958, when Charles de Gaulle established the Fifth Republic. But this year, that's likely to change. You have Marine Le Pen, the Front National candidate. You have Emmanuel Macron, who, as you say, has an establishment pedigree, but who ultimately has founded his own party, which is this kind of neo-Gaullist hodgepodge of both the left and the right. And then you have, aside from Benoît Hamon, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who is a radical leftist, who in fact shares certain endgame priorities with Le Pen. You know, he would also seek to fundamentally renegotiate France's membership in the European Union, and then if Europe didn't comply, would also seek a Frexit, or so he has said. So it's a contest of outsiders, but then also on a profound level, what we're seeing is the rise of political extremes in a system that has not ever really embraced them in this way, it would seem.
Well, in the global populist and nationalist moment, all eyes are on France. First round of voting on Sunday. And if no clear winner, this election goes to May. James McCauley, Paris correspondent for The Washington Post. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Last night, Arkansas executed a death row inmate for the first time since 2005. The state had planned to execute 8 inmates over 11 days after one of the drugs it uses in its lethal injection cocktail was due to expire at the end of the month. This has all touched off a wave of last-minute court challenges and media attention. Court decisions have stayed 3 of the scheduled executions. But last night, the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 to allow the execution of Liddell Lee, who was sentenced to death in 1995 for the murder of his neighbor, Deborah Reese. Lee maintained his innocence until he died. Sarah Weitz-Kotacek is a reporter for Arkansas Public Media, and she explains how this all went down.
The United States Supreme Court weighed in and decided not to hear an appeal of a federal case that had stayed all the executions. And then about 15 minutes before Lee's execution warrant would have expired, they denied various stays to block his execution. So it was carried out.
And when are the next scheduled executions? And do we expect more similar attempts by their lawyers for interventions from the courts?
The next scheduled execution is Monday. There are 3 dates set next week. Only 3 men are still legally set to be executed. One has been granted a stay by a federal judge. And yes, I would expect a similar flurry of litigation from, you know, right up until the last minute, as we've seen both nights so far.
And so once the state gets past the expiration date for midazolam, which is one of the drugs at issue here in the lethal injection protocol, what happens in Arkansas if the governor can't get all of these men executed as he would wish?
Of course, the governor didn't expect all 8 to be executed in this month, and that they expected these court issues, and that, I guess, was an implicit response to a lot of the national and international media attention that's been drawn by the schedule of 8 men in April set to be executed. The Department of Correction says they can't get another supply of midazolam, that in the past they've said that and then eventually been able to get the various drugs needed. But obviously they're experiencing great difficulty, and it's unclear how long it will take them to get another supply of the drugs.
Does Arkansas have an alternative to lethal injection?
The alternative on the books is electrocution chair. There's been talk about a firing squad, in that the attorneys, inmates argue that is a more viable and less potentially painful method of death. And lawmakers have not made any serious momentum toward actually legalizing a firing squad. So the state law allows the 3-drug protocol that they're using now and the use of a single drug that the state says it has not been able to get.
And Sarah, is there any sense in Arkansas, as this drama goes on day after day, the country and even the world paying such close attention to this, that it's going to have any impact on the broader debate over the death penalty?
Well, I think there was some thought, even until yesterday, that this U.S. Supreme Court might hear this case about the use of midazolam as an anesthetic. A federal judge ruled here in Little Rock that she was convinced by expert witnesses who said this won't block pain and that it's not commonly used alone as an anesthetic. And then as the U.S. 8th Circuit Court of Appeals denied that, and then the U.S. Supreme Court didn't hear it, there was some conjecture that because there have been a circuit splits on this issue before, and because the Supreme Court hasn't actually ruled about the science of midazolam, there are very few human studies about it, its effect, that they might take this up. At this point, legally, I don't know that there can be as big of a precedent set at this point as we might have expected a few days ago.
Sarah Weitz-Kotacek, reporter for Arkansas Public Media. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
The Takeaway is supported by Hot Girls Wanted, Turned On, a Netflix original documentary series from Rashida Jones, Jill Bauer, and Ronna Gratis, the women who brought you the critically acclaimed film Hot Girls Wanted. The series explores the intersection of sex and technology in a digital age and covers 6 true stories inside a world that is faking it. A 2017 Sundance Film Festival official selection, Hot Girls Wanted, Turned On is now streaming only on Netflix.
I have had it with these monkey fighting snakes on this Monday to Friday play.
We
be sloppy. We call it sloppy.
These sound like a great big chicken just waiting to be plucked.
Let's get that beauty scar, tough guy, eating pineapple.
This is bozo, man.
See what happens, Larry? See what happens when you find a stranger in the Alps?
It's Friday when we talk movies here on The Takeaway, and that means that Rafer Guzman is with us, film critic for Newsday. Hi, Rafer.
Hey, Todd.
Great to have you. Rafer, before we get started, I want to hit you with trivia because that's one of my favorite things. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
Okay, we're going to talk about The Lost City of Z. That's one of your reviews, a new movie in just a moment. It's a story of white explorers going deep into the Amazon jungle to find things that they didn't expect. So here's your trivia. Listen to this clip from 1991 from a movie on a similar theme, white missionaries heading into the Amazon, discovering the error of their ways.
Well, let me just tell you personally, as an American, I would be very proud to have Indian blood. Yeah, and I think that there's a lot of Americans would be proud to have it.
Just how much Indian blood would most Americans be proud to have?
Now, you're listening there to Tom Berenger and Aidan Quinn. Don't answer yet, Rafer. Keep it in mind. We'll come back to it. Listeners, if you know this 1991 movie, here's a hint. All-star cast, John Lithgow, Daryl Hannah, Kathy Bates. Name the film. We'll come back to it, Rafer. Let's see if you get this one. But let's go to Lost City of Z. Now, I mentioned this is a movie on a theme into the Amazon, right?
That's right. It's about the British explorer Percy Fawcett, who went into the Amazon looking for what he called the Lost City of Z. This was before Machu Picchu and the idea that, brown-skinned savages could build a civilization of their own was ridiculous back then. But he insists it's there, and he goes on repeated trips back to the jungle to find it.
Let's give it a listen.
The environment's brutally difficult. Terrible disease. Murderous savages, the journey may well mean your life. At the very least, you will be gone for several years. But were you to succeed, such an undertaking could earn you soldierly decoration and even reclaim your family name.
Rafer, I love a period piece, and I like Sienna Miller, who's in this one as well.
Yeah, she plays Percy's wife. I'm glad you mentioned her because one thing I like about this film is, it's common to see these very male-centric, jungle adventure films, and the wife usually stays at home, of course, and does nothing, which happens in this film too. But Sienna Miller is so good in this movie, and the director James Gray, I think, really gives her a lot of credit and really gives her a lot of a meat to that role. So you realize what Percy Fawcett is giving up, his family, his wife, years at a time out in the jungle. Charlie Hunnam is great as Percy Fawcett, and you know who's great in this movie? Robert Pattinson plays a fellow explorer. He's really solid, really strong performance. I love this movie from top to bottom. It's beautiful, very thought-provoking, and a very different jungle explorer film, I thought.
Well, that's something that's a positive review. And here's a film that we're going to move on to that's probably slightly less trenchant, maybe a little less deep, I don't know, than Lost City of Z. This is Born in China. John Krasinski has been on the show before. This is his new vehicle, Animals in China. Listen.
This is Yaya, a giant panda. Pandas are basically the opposite of monkeys. They're not interested in stirring up trouble. They just want to be left alone to eat and relax and scratch various different areas.
Rafer, somebody lifted that music from the Shire scenes of Lord of the Rings, but beyond that, what do you think?
Exactly. Yes, exactly. I like the Disney nature movies quite a bit. Chimpanzee was one of my favorites from that studio. And this is a good film. It's nice to see all these animals, a snow leopard, panda, a monkey. I feel this film's a little on the manipulative side. I really think it's forcing these kid-friendly narratives into the film. I guess that's okay. It's worth it if you can get your kids to sit through a wildlife documentary. I would have liked to see some mention about the environmental problems of China. I don't think every nature doc needs to hit you over the head with that, but China is particularly worrisome. That's not in here. But if you do buy a ticket to this on opening week, Disney Nature will fund a portion of that to the World Wildlife Fund. So that is something.
So for a good cause. All right, don't get whiplash because we go from a kid-friendly movie back to Oscar Isaac, Christian Bale, and Charlotte Le Bon. This is The Promise, and it's all about the Armenian genocide. Listen.
Mikhail, leave these people alone. You're safe in the woods.
No, no, I'm not safe. No one here is safe. Don't you see what's happening?
We've lived through these Turkish threats before.
Threats? They want us dead. I have to get us out of here before there's no time left. Trust me.
Rafer, I got excited when I saw Christian Bale and Oscar Isaac on the bill here because they're two of my favorites, but how did it go?
I love both of them as well. I guess I would start with a little bit of backstory. This is essentially a propaganda film. It was funded by Kirk Kerkorian, the businessman who's of Armenian descent, and he wanted this to be a film about the Armenian genocide, which, as we all know, the Turks refused to call it that. I just don't think it works to have this sort of hackneyed romance love triangle play out in front of such a tricky and touchy and complicated subject as the genocide. Even though I think this film's intentions were good on that front, I just don't think it works as a piece of entertainment at all.
All right, that's The Promise from Kirk Kerkorian, all about the Armenian genocide. Now, let's get you back to trivia, Rafer, because you know how much I love to stump you. We were basing this on your review of The Lost City of Z, explorers, white explorers heading into the Amazon, finding trouble that they didn't expect, and I played you this clip from a film from 1991. Listen.
Well, let me just tell you personally, as an American, I would be very proud to have Indian blood. Yeah, and I think that there's a lot of Americans would be proud to have it.
Just how much Indian blood would most Americans be proud to have?
Now you're listening to an idealistic missionary, Aidan Quinn, an American Indian, Tom Berenger, 1991. Rafer, name the film.
Todd, you've stumped me yet again. I'm drawing a blank.
This is an epic four-hour drama called At Play in the Fields of the Lord, which
yes.
Didn't do as well as it should have. John Lithgow, Daryl Hannah, Kathy Bates, and even Tom Waits star in this movie. It's a long one, but boy, if you got the time on a rainy day, watch it. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, thanks so much.
Thank you, Todd.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering copy and print solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen. And Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turn cognitive research tasks into games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
State your name, rank, and intention.
The Doctor. Doctor. Fun.
Doctor Who! Hey! The TARDIS!
Oh! Fantastic!
Can you just hurry up, please, or I'll hit you with my shoe?
Hello. I'm the Doctor. Basically, run.
Springtime is really here. The days are a lot longer, the nights are shorter, and that means you have to pick your nighttime viewing very carefully. That's why we have Melissa Locker here. She's culture reporter for Time, for The Guardian, and for us here at The Takeaway. And Melissa has a strong suggestion for you. It's Watch Doctor Who. That's the long-running, time-traveling British sci-fi show. It's been on the air for over 50 years and has a strong cult following here in the United States. Now, this is not the old version of Doctor Who you may have seen on TV as a kid. The 10th season of the rebooted series started last week. It can be hard to feel like you can just jump into a series that's been on the air for so long with all the talk of the TARDIS and Daleks, of course, but Melissa is here to tell you why Doctor Who is worth your time.
Up until about 2 years ago, I had never seen a single Doctor Who episode. I just, for some reason, felt like I had enough with Star Trek and Star Wars and Douglas Adams that I didn't need to add Whovian to my kind of nerd resume. But I will admit now that I'm wrong. The 10th season just started, but Amazon Prime currently has all of the reboot season, which goes back to the Doctor played by Christopher Eccleston, and then goes to David Tennant and Matt Smith and now Peter Capaldi. And people have very, very strong feelings about which Doctor they like best. And the only way to know which camp you fall into is to watch all of the episodes.
So then the new season is season 10. It's just started, right? I mean, even just a couple of days ago. Can people jump in now?
People can absolutely jump in now. A lot of the episodes are standalone. Sometimes there are stories that carry you through, and having kind of a general sense of what this show is about can definitely help. But you can also just watch one episode and see if you like it. My kid started watching, and he has no attention span to watch, you know, 10 episodes and carry a storyline through. So there are some that you can pick and choose that are just fantastic and definitely are standalone.
So what's the feel of Doctor Who now? Does it have a more modern feel, sort of the way, you know, when Battlestar Galactica rebooted, a lot of fans were really, really pleased because of the gritty sort of update that they did. How does Doctor Who feel?
Doctor Who definitely feels modern. Season 10 goes back to Peter Capaldi, who's playing the Doctor. He is a university professor, and he's surrounded by very modern university students, and he has a brand new companion. The Doctor almost always travels with a companion.
Tell you what I don't understand. You've been lecturing here for a long time. Like 50 years, some people say.
Yeah, and you're thinking, well, he doesn't look old enough.
No, I'm wondering what you're supposed to be lecturing on. One time, you were going to give a lecture on quantum physics. You talked about poetry.
Poetry, physics, same thing.
And this time she is a young black woman who happens to be gay, which is a big change for a show that has consistently had very pretty white women who always have sort of a strange love interest or not with the Doctor. But that's a different story. But it's very modern. It's very contemporary. It's going to have a lot of, you know, not necessarily correlations to today's, like, political environment, but there certainly are lessons that carry through whatever season you're watching.
Not to give too much of a ringing endorsement to your review here, but it sounds like adults and kids can both kind of get into it. That was a bit of a problem. I keep comparing it to Battlestar Galactica for some reason, but that reboot was a little bit scary. Kids probably didn't want to watch too much of it.
I totally agree. Battlestar Galactica's reboot was very adult, but a lot of Doctor Who is very, very kid-friendly or family-friendly. Maybe not super young kids who may be confused by the plot, but you can also pick and choose which doctor you go to. Like, my son, who's 9, is not a big fan of the current doctor, Peter Capaldi, because he is kind of a darker version of it. But if you go find Matt Smith's episodes, which are a lot of the stuff that you can find on Amazon Prime right now, he is 100% kid-friendly right out of the box. He just starts interacting with a little girl, and all he's eating is fish sticks and custard.
So your aunt, where is she?
She's out.
And she left you all alone?
Not scared.
Of course you're not. You're not scared of anything. Box falls out of the sky, man falls out of the box, man eats fish custard. And look at you, just sitting there. So you know what I think?
What?
Must be a hell of a scary crack in your wall.
And children just absolutely fall in love with them.
Melissa Locker is watching Doctor Who this week. You know, Melissa, I always have to make sure when there's a Doctor Who conversation, what's the Dalek count in the first episode?
Don't worry, there's one Dalek.
That's enough, though.
That's more than enough. He will exterminate the Doctor.
Exterminate! Melissa Locker, culture reporter for Time, for The Guardian, and for us. Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you.
In Havana, Cuba, in an old church late at night, the Havana Lyceum Orchestra is tuning up for a performance they might not have dreamed of a few years ago. Back then, it was nearly impossible for Americans and Cubans to travel to visit each other.
It's like a dream, of course, for us, for every musician, for every artist. It's amazing. And playing in this great concert hall with Simone, with the orchestra, is like a dream. And we are so happy, and we hope that we can do it.
That's Jose Antonio Mendez Pedron. He's music director of the Havana Lyceum Orchestra. The group's been tirelessly rehearsing two Mozart piano concertos with American pianist Simona Dinnerstein. It's all part of an album by Dinnerstein called Mozart in Havana. The album is out today, and in June, the orchestra debuts in the United States, and that will mark the first time an orchestra of this size has traveled to the United States from Cuba since the revolution. So here now is one of those performances, along with Simona Dinnerstein's reflections on the experience.
These concertos that I'm recording, Kreutzfeldt 467 and 488, have been two of my favorite piano concertos. I've wanted to record them. I've had sort of attempts to record them. and nothing has ever been quite right. Well, we're recording in an old church called Oratorio Neri. Interestingly, at the front, instead of having a crucifix, has an enormous clock. I don't really know what that signifies. It's a stopped clock. And it's a very reverberant space, but it actually produces a very beautiful sound for me when I'm playing. It's in a very kind of disheveled street in Old Havana, where there's lots of sort of garbage and crumbling buildings outside, but also a tremendous amount of character. And we have to record very, very late in the middle of the night because there's just so much activity going on during the day, and it's a building that sort of lets all the sound from the street come in, and so you have to kind of choose your moment to capture the music. Last summer, I came to Havana to perform in a festival that my old piano teacher, Solomon Mikowski, organizes. And he had me perform one of these Mozart concertos with this orchestra. And I had no idea what to expect. I actually didn't expect very much, to be honest. And we performed the concerto, and I was so blown away by their sound, their feeling, and their feeling for Mozart, which has to have a kind of sound that is somewhat burnished sound, but also very, very sensitive and very subtle. The way that I feel the music and that I like to interpret the music is in a very kind of free and lyrical way, almost as if the piano is a voice instead of an instrument. The people in the orchestra are extremely proud to be Cuban, and they identify very strongly with being Cuban, and there's the feeling that they're trying to be as great as they possibly can in the service of the music that they're playing. And there isn't really an end goal. I mean, if they get into an orchestra, like a professional orchestra, it's not like they're going to get a great salary. They won't. The only motivation for playing really well is the goal of playing the music really well. There's something about doing it for itself that I feel we don't have as much in the United States. It's rare to find people that are doing it for the love of doing it. I was very fortunate in having a couple of friends in the United States donate new strings and reeds to the orchestra. So the entire orchestra, the whole string section has a complete set of new strings, each one of them, which is actually quite an expensive thing to achieve. And Jose, the conductor, told me that, in fact, most of them had never played on an instrument that had four strings from the same company, you know? Last year, I performed with them here in Havana, and he was telling me about the strings and how they had to preserve the strings and they had to tune to a slightly lower pitch in order for the strings not to break. And some of the people were even using telephone wire for one of the strings, and it just was a really difficult situation because it's hard for them to afford to buy new strings. This orchestra is playing on inferior instruments, and they sound really as good, if not better, than any of the top orchestras I've ever played with. And that's what I can't understand, is that how do they create this sound that's a kind of glowing sound that's so hard? I mean, part of it is that they're very unified. They play together, and they blend with each other. But they manage to make themselves sound like they're playing on top quality instruments, and that's an incredible achievement. These are college-age musicians, and some of them are already graduated from college. They come from the School of the Arts here in Havana, and they are so well-trained. They have this tradition that has been passed on to them, that musical tradition that extends back, you know, hundreds of years. And they've been actually also going to Salzburg, and they've become really well-known here for their Mozart because of that. And this orchestra, they really treat each other like family. And I've not seen any kind of arguments amongst each other. If one of them has a problem, they all try to fix it. It's really nice. I felt that I'd found the orchestra to play Mozart with.
That's pianist Simona Dinnerstein playing with the Havana Lyceum Orchestra. Their performance is being released today on the new album Mozart in Cuba. And our special thanks to Rupert Allman for all of his help with that story. That's all for us today. You are always part of the conversation here. Give us your take at 8778MyTake. You can send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And you can find me on Twitter as well. I'm at Todd Zwillick. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend, everybody. I am Todd Zwillick sitting in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.